a lot of the people that I've spoken to have held on to the experience they've had when, and sometimes this is ongoing, when they've maybe been turned away from a service, often general practice or mental health services or housing, because they're known to use drugs of some sort. And they remember that and think therefore services are not for them. And there's still something around how do we shift that narrative that that should no longer be the case, and how do we also make sure that that is no longer the case, because it does still happen.
When Disciplines Meet is a series of podcasts from the Scottish Graduate School of Social Science, the UK's largest doctoral training partnership for social scientists. With these podcasts, we aim to discuss the aims, nature, and practical experiences of interdisciplinary approaches to research. This episode is on the topic of the Interdisciplinary Drugs Death Challenge. My name is Laura Young, and I'm an interdisciplinary researcher and host of this podcast series. On this episode, I am joined by three guests based across Scotland. Dr. Katrina Connell from the University of Stirling. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Also, Moira McKenzie from the Digital Health and Care Innovation Centre, which is hosted at the University of Strathclyde. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also Dr. Richard Lowry from the Centre for Homelessness and Inclusion Health at the University of Edinburgh. Welcome.
Thank you.
And this episode is, of course, about the Drugs Death Challenge. And if anyone is not in this space or sector or work with this, they are maybe only familiar with hearing about this once a year when we get the statistics out about the number of deaths in Scotland. And we almost always are coming out top when we look at the UK, Europe, and even sometimes globally for the number of deaths that we have. And I know that all of you are working on this challenge from different disciplines. So I thought that's maybe a good starting question, is actually just to ask you, what discipline are you from, Moira?
So my background is actually in housing. So my professional background through the University of Stirling, got my housing diploma there, used to manage homeless services in West Lothian. I then moved into the Scottish Government, doing some policy work, into the NHS, where again I was doing digital intervention. So I'm a bit of a mixture of different things, although that was my original background, my professional discipline.
Thank you. Katrina?
Yeah, similar to me, my background, my professional discipline is in occupational therapy. So I spent 10 years working in services for people involved in the criminal justice system who also had mental health difficulties. And then as I've moved over into research, what discipline? I would say health sciences would be my sort of natural place, but I work a lot with social scientists and with colleagues in different disciplines. So I would say health science.
Yeah. And Richard?
Thanks. So I'm a pharmacist by trade. I have been for 25 years or so, still am, clinical practice, where I work as an independent prescriber for people who are homeless in Edinburgh, done that over the last 15 years or so. In addition to my main role, which has been to lead research and development in NHS GGNC, and now I'm over in Edinburgh as a reader in the Centre for Homelessness and Inclusion Health, which just means that I do even more research and continue my kind of clinical practice.
It's great to hear the different disciplines that are already in this conversation, because people might only jump to medicine or public health when they think about this. But actually, as you've all mentioned, it's really important to me, including things about criminology, about poverty, housing, sociology, psychology, politics, all of these different disciplines. But Moira, I'm just wondering, the statistic that people might be familiar with is that Scotland has the worst drug deaths in Europe. Sometimes that has even been the world. But could you just give us a bit more of the kind of context where we have this conversation?
Yeah, sure. So the figures, the annual statistics are published around about September every year. So the most recent figures are the up till March 23 statistics. So again, they tell us that compared to the previous year before that, there was an increase of 12% in drug deaths. Vast majority of those deaths are men. So 70% are men, roughly 30% women. And in terms of actual numbers, that was 1,172 people died. And obviously the consequences and impacts on their friends, their family, their communities that they live in. So it's obviously much wider than the individuals themselves. Most of that general increase, as I say, is in men, so 805 men. And the general profile, however, has been consistent for a number of years. So some changes in the substances, and I'm sure Richard will have more detail on that, but the substances that are being used have changed slightly over the period. So roughly in all deaths, about 80% there are opioids still involved within that. But increasingly people are using a mixture of different drugs, including increases in cocaine use, gabapentin, pregabalin. So again, Richard will be more of the expert on that than I am. The average age of people who die is 45, which sounds very young when you think about it in that context. And the highest incidence of death is occurring in the 35 to 54 age group. That's changed, that's increased slightly over the years. So again, you know, some discussions round about whether it's people that have survived for a longer period of time that are pushing up that average age group. However, the thing that's probably most noticeable increasingly is that the deaths are occurring in our least deprived communities. So if you live in our least deprived community, you're 15 times higher and more likely to die from a drug-related death than if you live in the highest area, so if you live in the most affluent area. So that, again, is quite useful for trying to work out where we target our interventions.
Yeah, and I think that's important to understand the human aspect of this as well. Yeah. and all these different factors. And yeah, Richard, thinking about, you know, what you're seeing from your background as a pharmacist and what you're seeing in that sort of clinical practice space, what has been the context that you come into this conversation with?
I suppose it's that when you meet people who are regularly overdosing and they've used drugs for 20, 30 years, most of their lives, then you get a strong impression for what they say would help. People aren't daft, you know. They have really clear insights as to why they're using drugs and why they keep using drugs. And often you get solutions from people. And I think for me anyway, it's about, you know, having the privilege of sitting with people and trying to help them through what I can do as part of the multidisciplinary team, but at the same time listening to what they're saying about what would help, you know, and then trying to convert that into research questions sometimes or service changes. So I guess my perspective is one about, you know, carefully listening to people and trying to do a wee bit more so that you can improve the lot, you know.
And when you talk about your interdisciplinary team, what are the different professions or individuals that are actually part of that support network?
Yeah, I mean, so all the way through the last maybe 15, 20 years, I've had teams where that's been, you know, multidisciplinary. So typically, you know, pharmacists, that's the kind of the team I've led with. But, you know, you've got nursing input, you've got GP input, you've got OT input, which is very important, you know, and podiatrists. You've got the mental health team who are absolutely needed, and you've got referral to specialists. They have to be involved in a lot of cases too. And the reason why I say that is because the people that we're trying to help here who are dying from overdoses have multiple health conditions, you know, and whilst they may be kind of 44, I think you mentioned there, you know, when they die, they'll have numbers of health conditions typically comparable to 85-year-olds who live in their own houses. And that's something we've shown. And the trouble is that most of the health conditions that these folk have are untreated, so that they can't access care in the way that you and I can. And so we have to do something different to make that better.
And Katrina, I know that your work has looked at specific subsets of communities that are impacted by this issue. I know that you have kind of linked your research to criminology and people in the justice system. You know, what context do you bring to this conversation about Scotland's drug death challenge?
I mean, that's right. So my research is all around the health of people in contact with the criminal justice system. And that has mostly focused on access to services, access to healthcare for mental health, but also for substance use. And I suppose we know from our research, but research that's gone before, that when people are released from prison, that's a really high risk time, which is probably where I've kind of come into this conversation, is looking at that pathway post-release and finding that the numbers there are really stark. So a recent study that we've done, although we weren't specifically looking at deaths, we did find that when we followed up people who'd been released from prison for 4 years, almost 1 in 10 people released will have died within 4 years. 1 in 10, and half of those would have been a drug-related death. So that's a huge chunk of drug-related deaths are people who have been in contact with the criminal justice system in some way. So there's hopefully avenues there, a group who can be, I don't want to say targeted, but who may benefit from specific interventions. And we've seen changes in the field in, gosh, since COVID and since the sort of drugs deaths crisis was named in Scotland. Things like introducing naloxone when people are released from prison, so everybody released who may have difficulties with substance use can or should be given naloxone, which is a sort of antidote for an opioid overdose or something like heroin, and change in different change in treatments. So there's a new medication called buprenorphine, which has been now can be delivered in prison and continued on release. So potentially things might have changed, or maybe that initial release period where things are at highest risk may have been pushed a bit further down the line. We need to do a bit of work to find out whether those changes have made an impact, and hopefully they have, because we see drug-related deaths of people who've been in contact with prison or with community justice, so people who don't go to prison but have some kind of a community sentence, are much higher than rates in similar people who haven't been to prison, and much higher still than sort of the general population. So when you think of kind of public health level targeting of perhaps where we're going to have the biggest impact, people who are in contact with the justice system are definitely a big proportion of those deaths we could focus on.
And when I hear you speaking, I hear you talking about the justice system, which is huge, and the health service, which is huge. You know, how do you find working with these two very complex, large institutions when tackling this issue?
As a researcher, I've worked mostly with sort of local authorities, actually, who sometimes coordinate drug and alcohol services in the community. And from the sort of more prison side, I've been much more working with kind of data rather than speaking to the people in prison. But when I've been working in a community context, working with voluntary sector and working with local authorities, I found because of the focus on health is maybe newer than some other research focuses with that population. People are generally really keen to support research in that space, is especially the population who've been sort of are supervised in the community. We know very little about that group in terms of their health. So yeah, there's been lots of enthusiasm for research in that space.
I mean, going to say it's interesting when Laura said, what do you think in working with these big institutions? But I always think it's easy to think about NHS Scotland as a single institution, but it's not. And the justice system's exactly the same. So you're kind of working your way down. I mean, at the end of the day, it's all about people, isn't it? It's about people and relationships. And NHS Scotland is made up of, you know, what is it, 14 territorial boards. There's a number of special boards. You've got health and social care partnerships. And I think partly the issue for people, citizens, is how do you navigate such a complex system? You know, what door do you knock on when you're looking for care and support? And then how do you ensure, is it the right door? Is that going to pass you on? Are they going to slam the door in your face? So there's a lot of issues around about navigation and knowing where to go for people. And we also touched on, you know, people coming out of the justice system. Points of transition have been identified. I think it was the University of Stirling through the Drugs Research Scotland network. Points of transition is important in terms of survival rates, if you like. And homelessness is another one. So, you know, people moving from one environment to another and it being very unsettled for them, you can see similarities there. The other one's discharges from hospital or where you've gone into hospital and then you maybe not even been taken in as an inpatient, you're discharged into the community. So those seem to be the kind of three points at which there are big challenges for individuals and how they work their way through that system. And again, as Richard said earlier, some insights into where we need to focus when we're trying to support people effectively.
And I think, I mean, you're right, Moira, you know, but I suppose from a patient's perspective, you're looking at continuity of care, you know, wherever you are. And relationships are key to protecting against overdose and getting healthy. Most of the people that we're currently talking about here maybe don't have the strength of relationships that are protective. And so absolutely, the points you've talked about there, people are at higher risk of overdose and death. We know that. But I don't think the system, whether it's the healthcare system, whether it's the prison system, criminal justice in totality, I don't think we've cracked it yet. I think people are still falling between the cracks wherever they go, and I think part of the reason for that is because all these systems you talked about are separate. They have separate governance, they have separate records. They see people and they look after them best they can, I'm included, you know, when people are with you. But then when folk move on, we don't follow them up the way that I think they probably need and certainly value from the work we've done with patients, you know. So I think until we get something that's joined up, we get a service that follows people and sticks to them, wherever they are, then I think we'll be keeping talking about this type of thing in another 10 years, you know. So one thing I would say on top of that is that, you know, when you're working in this area, I know both of you have for a long while, you know, you realise eventually that it's often the third sector who are the ones who provide continuity of care, comprehensive care, and try to support people. They're normally the first point of contact. And if you look back to the reasons and the kind of underlying assumptions about primary care, a lot of what third sector are providing is exactly what we think is needed to provide primary care, to prevent things happening, whether it's overdoses or you know, mental health crises, or physical health issues, worsening substance dependence. Stronger primary care systems generally prevent these things happening, but we've not really got that now. And there's lots of reasons for that we don't have that, and not the time to go into them or the remit, you know. But a key one is that I don't think we have the extent of outreach from general practitioners and general practice that we used to have maybe 30, 40 years ago. You know, so I mean, there's big challenges that I don't see how they're going to change unless we do some transformational research that demonstrates the benefits and the cost effectiveness of all these things. So but we're trying hard to do that, but that's also quite difficult, you know.
I think I've worked really closely with voluntary sector organisations in one part of Scotland, and one of the things that I've noticed as a couple of things are just that you've said that have made me think is access to these is not equal. So in some parts of the country, there's tons of voluntary sector organisations doing fantastic work, and you're almost tripping over yourself for options. And other parts of the country, sometimes more rural areas or outside of the big city, it's really difficult to find. I found it difficult to find voluntary sector organisations with the internet, with the skills that I've got. So there's definitely something around just that being equitably available. And the other was other thing that I thought about was about relationships, and that relationship with general practice sometimes broke down a long time ago. And a lot of the people that I've spoken to have held on to the experience they've had when, and sometimes this is ongoing, when they've maybe been turned away from a service, often general practice or mental health services or housing, because they're known to use drugs of some sort. And they remember that and think therefore services are not for them. And there's still something around how do we shift that narrative that should no longer be the case, and how do we also make sure that that is no longer the case, because it does still happen.
I think quite a lot of times people do kind of remember these experiences, but then there's underlying issues to do with childhood experiences that are dominant and haven't really been addressed or brought out. And I think a lot of what we're talking about here in terms of overdoses and deaths, premature mortality and morbidity is quite often largely got to do with things that have happened way, way downstream.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I mean, a lot of the help that folk would get to equip them better to deal with things is just not available, you know, in terms of mental health support. The intensity of that and the type of mental health support is just not available. We have to do better, I think.
For me, that's part of the reason why. One of the projects that we're supporting is the Digital Lifeline Scotland programme, which is very much exploring how digital could actually reach into some of the rural communities or enable people to access services in a different way, in a way that works for them. So that was kind of kicked off back in 2021 in the midst of COVID. And again, was a, here's a great idea, what do we do? So it's been very much an iterative kind of research-led activity. So with each stage, we've kind of done something and then looked at it and said, well, did it work? Did it not work? Which bits of it work? And that's turned out to be really useful for us, because it was very much based on that whole, you know, Scottish approach to service design approach, where it's all about working with people with lived experience or living experience and making sure you're trying to design something that works for them in the terms that they're in. So not to say we've cracked everything, because we haven't, but, you know, really getting to over 5,500 people now, supporting them, supporting many of the third sector services that are supporting them as well. So trying in a way, which you'd reinforce there, Richard, the need to join things up round the person, but the person, you know, we say person-centred all the time, but the person really being in the midst of all of that has been crucial. And recent, the evaluation was just published last week or this week, saying that this is a really positive experience from a programme, and we've just launched our next year. So all good stuff.
So to what extent does that type of support reach the people who need it most, Moira? What, I mean, the folk I'm thinking about are the guys who are overdosing all the time.
Yep.
2 weeks ago in Edinburgh, 5 people died from overdoses within a week in the city centre. You don't hear much about it. And most of these folks, I'm guessing, I know some of their friends, I've spoken with them, they don't really have access to the mobile phones and technology that's needed to alert people that something's going wrong, you know. So that don't, those are the folk that generate the figures that make us the worst.
I know, and I do think to some extent it depends on, this is the big limitation with it, it depends on to what extent they are engaging with services that are involved in the programme. So there's 35 mainly third sector organisations that have been engaging. The key partners in it, so DHI are kind of facilitating the whole programme, but we work very closely with Simon Community Scotland and the Scottish Council for Voluntary Organisations. So SCVO have been pushing those grants out to local services on the ground, as I say, mainly third sector. And Simon Community Scotland have been working, again, very, they do frontline services, obviously, if you'll be aware, really keen to be developing digital products that help people. So one of the things that they've been developing is a digital service called By My Side. And what it's doing is connecting people in, what are the local services in your area that might be of benefit? Now, whether it's the local church group, or whether it's, you know, here's a service that operates at 11 o'clock on a Friday night, you know, they're starting to pull together quite a lot of those resources. But that all depends on people's confidence with digital. So the work that Scottish Council for Voluntary Organisations have been doing is very much about digital upskilling, not just the individuals themselves, but the services. So you can't assume that every service is very digitally upbeat about everything. You know, you'll get the same resistance as you do in kind of normal environments.
Do you think we could use that more directly to help
some
of the folk we're talking about in this podcast? So I'm thinking about people who are using multiple drugs all the time, overdose regularly.
Yeah.
Quite often, these folks don't know that there's a trend appearing in terms of more overdoses and more deaths. And I'm often mindful that if they had access to mobile phones and if we knew the mobile phone numbers, we could almost pass on information really quickly to alert people of the dangers. But I don't think we're at that stage.
Well, we are at that stage. So again, they need to have access to the digital devices. So there's this big program that's pushing out the devices. The devices are provided to people free. They're also given connectivity, so they get data connectivity as well. But the probably more important bit is the digital upskilling. You know, the why do you go online? What's the motivation for you to go online? And different experiences of being, you know, one guy only got his kids at the weekend, his daughter at the weekend, so he was really interested in the Disney Channel. Do you know, so he was, that got him online. Really interested in, how do I get access to that? You know, my daughter's really going to love it. So you've got to find the hook that even encourages people to get on. But yes, so the devices and the data connectivity are there through these 35 organisations that have been engaging. But Simon Community Scotland, through their By My Side app, I feel like I'm doing a plug now for Simon Community Scotland. They've been working with Public Health Scotland, so the NHS in effect, interdisciplinary, to push the alerts through. So they're pushing the alerts through onto this app to say, this is what's going on in terms of the drugs that are hitting the streets just now and some of the issues that are occurring. So the next phase of development that they're working on just now is to get that really localised. So if I'm living in, you know, Ayrshire and there's a particular problem hitting the streets in my community, how do I know about it and how do I get an alert? That's for staff as well as for individuals themselves. But we're also trying to work through what's the kind of language. I mean, you'll have seen the radar alerts that come through. So looking at how you translate those radar alerts into the types of terminology.
That's easy.
Great, we'll get you involved in all
that's
of
easy.
That.
So Moira, that's the easy bit. You just ask folk.
Yeah.
You know, so you would tell somebody this is what's coming through. How would you describe that? And I would record their message and send that out in a voice message. Dead easy, you know.
So I think Simon Community Scotland have got a bit of a
group. Simon Community Scotland I've worked with for years. I still do.
So it's definitely coming out. Excellent. So again, we'll link you into that and you can start promoting it.
Yep.
That's really great to hear. It's one of the elements of a second study I was running was looking at people's social networks and how important they are in influencing an individual. And often people talked about, we weren't specifically looking at drug-related deaths, we were looking at access to healthcare, but often people talked about how their network didn't know what was a problem, didn't know when to get help, how to get help, or where to get help. And one of the things that really came out of it was, instead of looking at that individual and trying to do something, looking at their whole network as a kind of, say, a unit of analysis, the thing I looked at, and how could we get that whole network more aware of, understanding of the difficulties, and if an app like this was owned by a whole network, even if the individual isn't able to engage with it, doesn't want to, the people around them would be able to say, this is what's hitting this area, you know, and just looking.
So, I mean, the digital stuff's good, you know, and there's applications. I'm thoughtful, though, that most of the people you speak to, if you ask them what would help prevent the next overdose, then it's not really about the digital stuff that they say, it's about relationships. It's about better drug treatment, you know. It's about having something to do during the day. The basic things that have been missed out in the previous lives that they've had, you know. And I quite often think we totally missed the point in the services that are here just now because it's so overly funded and focused on the kind of the health needs, direct health needs, whereas the wider benefits of offering somebody an opportunity to do things during the day, such as a Simon Community do routinely through social prescribing, in other words, you know, is probably the bigger gain for most people, because it means that they build relationships, especially if it's kind of group activities, and they get opportunities to relive their lives again, you know. So the digital works for some folk, but even some people, you know, I'm speaking to just now, are just out of prison, they've been there for 20 years, they've kind of missed the whole of the digital revolution. Yeah. So,
and digital's just a tool. At the end of the day, it's one of the tools, isn't it?
It's not
a means, it's not an end in itself, it's really a mechanism. But some of the research that we've been doing is identifying that people do feel they've connected. Yeah. So they're connecting back with their friends and their communities and their families in a way, you know, how it's kind of easier when you're on the phone, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You're sending a message to someone and if they don't respond, they don't respond. It's much, much kind of less emotional than it is turning up at the door and then seeing whether, you know, somebody's going to let you in or not. Yeah. Yep. So I think, again, it's a mechanism which kind of unpicks some of these big issues that people are saying are out there for them. And again, how do you find out what it is that's going on in your area or your hobbies or the courses that you might be able to access through the college? So definitely not an end result itself, but how many of us are sitting with devices now that we are? I get on the train every night and, you know, just about every person on the train whips out their smartphone and, you know, that's
it. So, I mean, there's a more direct application of the digital side of things, I suppose, to prevent overdose, that being drug deaths, and that is, I mean, the Scottish Government just now, through the CSO, the Office for Life Sciences, have got the Drug Death Innovation Challenge, you know, and there's maybe 7 or 8 different projects that have been funded to try and find innovations that lead to early detection and alerts being sent in the event that somebody overdoses. Some of the projects are quite well advanced now. I'm working with one of the teams, and they've designed a device which sticks onto your chest, and when your heart rate and your oxygen saturations and your movement gets a certain threshold, the idea is that it would send a message, you know, through to maybe the ambulance service or next of kin, at least, to say obviously there's something not quite right. All these things, they're very early on, though, and I think they're, as you say, Moira, they're additions, they're options, they're tools in the box. But the core thing, I think, here is that, you know, maybe we need to do more to reach out, to engage repeatedly with folk who we know are high risk, whether it's after being in hospital or after being in jail, and follow them long term, you know.
And we also need to get them to them before, you know, so the prison system's really interesting as part of that. You know, can you reach into the prisons and actually make those connections at a time before people are coming out and, you know, kind of looking about for connections themselves? So I know that Social Work Scotland have been progressing a trial with Stirling Prison, HMP Stirling, looking at the use of the Near Me video consulting platform. So you'll probably be familiar with that already. So that's very much a video-based, video conferencing-based platform, which is allowing services to reach into the prisons for people that are about to be discharged, is never the word that you use, released, from the prison system.
Liberated.
So reaching in before they come back into their communities again and trying to piece together the types of support that they will benefit from in the community. It's also helping things like family visits, you know, where you're maybe living in an area which makes it really difficult to visit the prisons. How do you create that connection back into the family network?
I think, folk when they're released from prison, you know, that quite often they're off their prescription. They need to go back on it again in order to reduce the risk of subsequent overdose. But services we have it just now are not as mobile as patients. Mm-hmm. They're static, they're building based. There are very few services across Scotland. NHS certainly have outreach functions enabling clinicians to go to people wherever they are, you know, and engage with them and then bring them back or else treat them on the spot, which we can do. And so I think we're definitely lacking there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the situation is in other countries, but maybe the drug deaths are not as bad, but it would be interesting to know whether outreach is part of the core function, you know.
Discussion about the Norwegian model to the prison system, where the idea is that they have a much more porous, I won't say border, but that services can come in and out much more fluidly and support people through that transition. And in Scotland, they've just commissioned a new national through care programme, which through care is what they call that transitional support. So before, that was only available to a limited number of people in custody, but now anyone can request through care. So it does rely on people saying that they would like that support. But if they do, almost everywhere in the country, they should be able to access that, including men and women on remand, which is often been a population that gets missed. So people who haven't been found guilty of their offence, they're awaiting trial, they can often be there for a short time, they're not allowed to access services. So now they're being included in this through care package, which is great because they're one of the highest risk groups. They're not in long enough to get support and they're not out long enough to get support. And so they get trapped in this, they call it a revolving door cycle of reoffending, often small drug-related crimes, back in custody. So if you are supporting anyone in prisons, they can be encouraged to ask for through care support, which is delivered by the third sector. Mm-hmm. And so it won't provide the actual support, but we'll be able to hopefully connect them to GP, pharmacist, any services, almost like a bit of a navigator. So that's newly recommissioned this year. So they're planning an evaluation of that to look at how well that goes. I suppose the challenge will always be getting those that are most or furthest from our door, that are not going to say, hey, please help, and trying to support that population. But they're conscious of it and thinking about how they can do that, including using like peers within prison. So other guys have had experience with substance use, men and women, going back in. Operating recovery cafes within the prison that can then support people on release. So I know Cisco run a cafe in Barlinnie, so that then the men and women men in contact there can continue on the outside. And some of their service users have supported our research by advising me and my colleagues. So we recognise that we don't necessarily have a lot of the experience that people in prison have. So they've come along and advised us, and they've been great for telling us when we're getting stuff wrong and when we're getting stuff right. So there's a lot of change, positive change happening in the Scottish Prison Service, and it'll just be, I suppose, a matter of seeing how well that works. And
there's huge opportunities for research in this area as well. Again, conscious of the main audience that we might be talking to here. And you'd referred to the Office for Life Sciences, the UK Office for Life Sciences earlier, and the work they're doing with the CSO. But they also recently published sort of the 10 big questions to ask roundabout research in this area. And I've got one of them written down in my notes, so I'll just check them. So again, they were talking about things like how can stigma and discrimination against people with addiction to drugs and or alcohol be addressed within health services to improve care. You know, so they've identified 10 areas, and if anyone's interested, they're published on the James Lind Alliance website. For people to go and look at that, because my assumption always is the Office for Life Sciences is going to fund research in these particular 10 areas, so might be of interest.
Yeah,
I'm always conscious as well that when you're speaking to people, quite a few certainly people are homeless in the Canary I work in. Quite a few people are keen to go back into prison because things on the outside are so bad, you know, persistently bad, and there's nothing for them, and so it will commit crimes with the purpose of getting back in, so that there's some stability, so that there's some regular function.
Regular meals?
Regular meals, Moira, exactly. And that doesn't say a lot for what we're providing outside for folk, and that's why I'm going back to the point about we need to really try and, I guess, redesign what we're doing in a way that meets their needs more than it does at present, because, like you said earlier, do you know what I mean? A lot of people are... that they're shy of going to hospitals or GP services or other services, and we need to do something that makes that better. We know why people don't want to go there, but we don't seem to be connecting up the dots and providing a service that goes to people wherever they are and follows them and offers them this kind of comprehensive care that we're all able to access, because, you know, we can drive or phone up and wait for 20 minutes on the phone for an appointment. So I don't think... I mean, we're talking here about, you know, drug debt. I don't think things will change unless we transform what we're currently offering.
I mean, I think as the non-expert in the room, I think it's been lovely to, I think, basically ask you one question and just see you all take on this conversation and hear all the different perspectives that you bring in. But absolutely no one has come to the table going, well, here's the silver bullet for solving this problem, and, you know, we won't be sitting talking about this next week because we've got this one policy change that we need. But actually there's all of these different elements that need to be considered, and no one of them is the perfect solution, but actually together they build it up. But I think, you know, Richard, what you mentioned as well about this being or I think more of saying person-centred, people-centred, and Richard, you talking about it, it's that relational part. You know, it is about building relationships, and people are complex. People have lots of different elements to them and their personalities and their lives, and actually we need to be addressing all of it. And so I guess, you know, as we wrap up this conversation, I guess I would love to just hear your final reflections on the areas of work that you sit in and how working with others, working with other disciplines, working in an interdisciplinary way, you know, what are your reflections on that? Especially because you all come from individual backgrounds, but you seem to have moved into a space where you work with others alongside this. You know, do we need individual disciplines? Is that what the solution is, or actually is it all about combating this together? Anyone can jump in on that question.
We absolutely need individual disciplines. I don't think, I mean, maybe others would contest that, but the kind of types of problem that people have, you know, types of health problem, types of social care problem, and within the health domain, it's, you know, mental health, it's substance dependency, and it's physical health issues, and lots of them. You absolutely need different disciplines to make sure that, you know, you're providing the best evidence-based care. But I think the challenge is how we provide that care. It's not whether we've got the experts and whether we can offer it. It's how we engage with people to provide that in a way that they find acceptable. And we need to recognise that people's needs are different, and this group are very different. But I don't think we've got it right. We've not changed things about. For example, we've not, you know, got really a system where if somebody falls off their methadone prescription, we don't really have a system where we react in a way that the, you know, the providers of care and the experts and the disciplines then go to that person to find where they are. Because for all they know, they could be lying somewhere. Mm-hmm. But there isn't that response. There isn't that nimbleness of the system to try and make things better. So I think until we knock that one in the head and we crack that particular problem, we'll forever have people dropping off what is an evidence-based approach and not benefiting, as well as others. The others being people who are more health literate and have more relationships and have, you know, better IT resources and they've got cars and, you know. So, I mean, it feels like we're worsening the kind of the disparities in health all the way through this whole process. But, you know, I guess one of the questions there, Laura, was about, you know, the research. Research is important. We need to show what might work and what doesn't work. And certainly when we're working in these kind of areas through the University of Edinburgh, we've got approaches that are complex but measurable, you know, and we're testing them in the context of trials, which have, you know, groups of people recruited, and some groups get the intervention, other groups don't. And it's done at random, and so you can compare and contrast things at the end of it to find out what works, you know. So that's a good tool to have in the box, you know, but it costs a lot of money and it takes a long time. But we're doing what we can, you know.
Katrina?
Yeah, I think I would agree that we need disciplines, because the depth and the breadth of expertise that we need to support people is too much for one person to do on their own. And definitely, it's been a while since I've been in practice, but we would always need people that brought a different perspective to the table. So I would come with an occupational therapy perspective, but there would be someone bringing a pharmacy perspective, and that helped us think about all the possible ways that we might support someone. And I think it's similar in research, in that you're coming at a challenge like drug deaths or anything, and you have people coming at it from a different kind of professional discipline, but also a different research discipline. So I've worked with criminologists and sociologists and policy researchers, which are all areas I know a bit about, but don't have that depth to really get into it. So I think that really brings that more rounded picture when you're doing research, and spots things that you don't see and things that you couldn't possibly know. And definitely having, I know that we haven't talked loads about involving people who have experience of using drugs in the solutions that we build. And I think that's really important, both in practice and also in research. And there's loads of work going on led by people with experience that will hopefully help us come up with not a silver bullet, but a number of possible ways to support people. And having lots of disciplines in the mix, I think, makes that hopefully more likely. It doesn't come without its challenges, of course, working interdisciplinarily. People think differently, approach differently, use different language, but I quite enjoy it. I find it quite exciting when somebody looks at something in a way I never have. And I think, well, why didn't I think of that? So, yeah, it definitely has its benefits. So, pro-discipline and pro-interdisciplinary.
And Moira?
So I say yes, disciplines are good, but I would probably go beyond that. So we do quite a lot of work with commercial companies. So Richard touched on the CSO demonstrators that are progressing, the 7 demonstrators. And what they are is a combination of the research environment, but also companies coming into that. So again, because our interest is obviously in the digital space, you are dependent on another very different skill set for how you develop things. And again, people very often think they know how to do digital things. But see, when you're talking to some of these commercial industry companies, I mean, honestly, your brain goes off in a completely different direction about what could be possible and what's coming down the track with regard to that. And I'm not even going to go into the AI space. So, yes, I would kind of move beyond just disciplines and think about kind of cross-sector. The other thing that's one of my bugbears is that Scotland's actually very good at innovation, and we've heard great examples of that today. Lots of good stuff is going on. But yeah, how do we join that up successfully, and how do we scale it? Because we're not good at scaling innovation in our country. So again, effort needs to go into that about how we kind of build these things to the next stage.
Well, that's certainly a lot of food for thought on this. And I just want to thank you for your time and expertise in bringing your own discipline to this conversation, both about how do disciplines work together, you know, when disciplines are meeting, but also, of course, on the topic of Scotland's drug death challenge. So thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
When Disciplines Meet is hosted by me, Laura Young, recorded at the podcast studio Glasgow, and edited by the operations team at the Scottish Graduate School of Social Science. The podcast was conceived by SGSSS's Deputy Director for Training, Dr. Katie Keenan, And Associate Director Dr. Roxanne Connolly, SGSSS is funded by the Economic and Social Research Council and the Scottish Funding Council and our 16 partner universities. To find out more about the Scottish Graduate School of Social Science, you can visit our website at www.sgsss.ac.uk. Thank you so much for listening.